Even things are a mess in the capital today. You should have been there 150 years ago when Southerner Edward Pollard wrote those words, published in 1867, in a volume in which he coined the term Lost Cause, initiating a re-mythologizing of the post-Appomattox Confederacy. Efforts to make America great again are not unique to the current president of the United States. In almost every era of our nation's history, someone has lamented the departure of American greatness and fretted that national oblivion, if not divine retribution, was at hand. Still others, dissenters mostly, have warned that claims of greatness themselves betray a certain national hubris and pride, even blindness to promises made but not yet kept. Their alternative demand might well be, today's title, Making America Great Again for the First Time. The rhetoric of American exceptionalism was there from the start, even linked to a covenant with the divine, a particular concern of various Protestant immigrants. Arriving in 1630, a group of non-separating English Puritans disembarked from the Arabella in Boston Harbor, having affirmed John Winthrop's composition called A Model of Christian Charity. And among other things, it declared, you all read that together out loud. Now.
We shall find not a cloud of Israel among us. When 10 of us shall be led to resist 1,000 of our enemies, he shall make us praise and glory, that men shall say of succeeding plantations, the Lord make it like that of New England. For we must consider that we shall be as a city upon a hill, and the eyes of all people are upon us.
Barely 30 years later, however, Boston clergyman Michael Wigglesworth issued his mournful 1662 Jeremiad. A Jeremiad is a mournful lament in rhetorical form. His Jeremiad denouncing the colony's spiritual and political shortcomings, written in the form of an epic poem entitled God's Controversy with New England. It began by affirming a divine plan for the discovery and settlement of at least what for the Europeans was this new land. Read this. Your turn. Go ahead.
This region was in darkness placed, far off from heaven's light, amidst the shadows of grim death and of eternal night. For there the sun of righteousness had never made shine the light of his sweet countenance and the grace which is above, until the time drew nigh wherein the glorious Lord of hosts was pleased to lead his armies forth into those foreign coasts.
The poem's conclusion, however, reflects Reverend Wigglesworth's fear that the grand God-ordained vision was already corrupt, if not lost altogether. Read that.
Beware, O sinful land, beware, and do not think it strange that sore judgments are at hand, unless thou quickly change, or God or thou must quickly change, or else thou art undone. Wrath cannot cease, its end remain, where judgment is begun.
American history is filled with exceptionalism and lost causes, sources of national or regional identity. repeatedly mythologized, demythologized, and remythologized. So this a myth, Mark Shorer wrote, you see the definition there, I won't make you read all that. A myth, Mark Shorer wrote, is a large controlling image that gives philosophical meaning to the facts of ordinary life. That is, which has organizing value for experience. That's a really important line. I think you should read it out loud. Read it one more time.
A myth is a large controlling image that gives philosophical meaning to the facts of ordinary life. That is, which has organizing value for experience.
Myths aid a nation, a society, an institution, or an individual to discover meaning in the facts of common existence. Guides for knowing who we are and where we fit or where we don't. The details of the myth do not have to be factual for the myth to be true. That is, a way of defining identity. Societies and individuals, even churches, must be wary, however, when shared visions and high mythic goals become simply alternative facts that result in exploitation, dehumanization, and the institutionalization of prejudice. Sometimes the myths won't hold. And there are always prophets and other dissenting outsiders who challenge them on the spot. The same myths that write people in can also write people out. The Redeemer Nation myth linked American exceptionalism with divine election. But deciding what groups or ideas are elect remains elusive and controversial to this very moment. The Lost Cause myth was useful in writing white Southerners back into a collective national identity after their terrible defeat in the Civil War. But it was secured at the expense of African Americans who were written out through the collective racism of Jim Crow legislation, voting rights denial, and separate but equal facilities. Collective identity, especially in a democracy, is difficult to develop and to sustain. Why is such communal consciousness worth exploring at this moment in American politics and religion? Perhaps because, if you'll see here, 7 out of 10 Americans, regardless of political affiliation, say that the land of the free and the home of the brave is losing its sense of shared identity. Even the most basic consensus on who we are as a people and what holds us together. That's what last month's Associated Press NORC Center for Public Affairs research poll suggests. Yet those respondents disagree as to the nature of national identity. Let's read A and B. Let's start with A. This is straight from the report. Read what it says.
About 5% of Democrats have a mix of old and old groups, which is mainly a very important one to American identity. Compared with 35% of Republicans. 29% of Democrats are Christianity is that important. Compared with 57% of Republicans.
Keep going.
Democrats are far more likely than Republicans to say that the ability of people to confiscate violence and persecution is very important. 74% to 55%. Also, 25% of Democrats have a culture of the country's early European immigrants is very important versus 46% of Republicans.
The sense of lost vision and identity is also present in the church as denominations and congregations experience decline, division, debate, and disengagement across the theological spectrum. Likewise, succeeding surveys reflect unrelenting increase of the nones, or the nuns. I don't use nun because that has two meanings. The nones, individuals who self-identify as having no significant engagement in traditional religious communities. Recent studies indicate that the number of religiously unaffiliated Americans increases annually. Currently, the largest single religious identification in the country at 25%, as contrast to the next largest group, white evangelicals, now at some 21%. Thus, one in five Americans claims no engagement within a religious community. That number increases with your generation to one in three millennials ages 18 to 30. Those demographic and religion-related developments create a major identity issue for American churches. Recent baptismal, membership, financial, and institutional declines in the Southern Baptist Convention are a dramatic case in point. Likewise, the rise in religion-related hate crimes, white supremacy rhetoric, KKK diatribes, and race-related changes in voting laws suggest that some of the worst lost cause-related ideologies are not lost in 21st century America. In many ways, rethinking the myth of America was at the heart of Donald Trump's election as 45th President of the United States. Indeed, his campaign slogan, "Making America Great Again," captures two central identity issues that include a belief in American exceptionalism, the unique place of the U.S. in history and among nations, and Trump's own lost cause deconstruction, and his intended reconstitution of the nation's perceived glory. Today we briefly explore the religious roots and contemporary implications of two historic elements of national and regional identity, American exceptionalism and lost cause ideology. The actual term American exceptionalism appeared late in our history, coined in the 1950s by communist organizer Jay Lovestone to explain why working class Americans found communism less appealing than did their European counterparts. Such American exceptionalism, Godfrey Hodgson writes, is the idea that the United States has a destiny and a duty to expand its power and influence, and the influence of its institutions and its belief until they dominate the world. But ideas of such national exceptionalism were there from the beginning, often shaped by what Stephen Walt calls the sense that the United States has a divinely ordained mission to lead the rest of the world. The phrase, lost cause, originated, Thomas Connelly and Barbara Bello suggest, as a byword for the perpetuation of the Confederate idea. How many of you have heard the phrase lost cause to talk about the South before? Hold your hands up. Okay, good. It was coined, as we said, by Edward Pollard, whose book of the same title set in motion additional publications, speeches, and populist movements for justifying the Southern experience. The lost cause ideology is multifaceted, born initially as a way in which Southern writers, preachers, and politicians sought to explain the defeat and memorialize the honored dead. It later served as a way of explaining the nature of Southernness itself, particularly on matters of race and religion, sexuality, and Americanism. The language of divine entitlement cast America as, these are phrases used, holy experiment, city on the hill, God's new Israel, and redeemer nation. In our most recent presidential election, certain Trump supporters, many no doubt among the 81% of evangelical voters who cast ballots for him, understood the Trumpian phrase, "Make America Great Again," as a reaffirmation, even restoration, of the nation's faith foundation in Christian orthodoxy and morality, concerns not unrelated to Redeemer Nation identity. Indeed, Franklin Graham, son of the evangelist, touted Trump's election as evidence of, his word, a divine hand in American political affairs. In an Election Day sermon entitled, "When God Chooses a Leader," Robert Jeffress, pastor of First Baptist Church Dallas, compared Trump to Nehemiah, who built a wall to protect Jerusalem. The language of American Zion continues. American chosenness, Ernest Lee Tosin says, had two kinds of exceptions for early North American settlers who promoted them. One was America as the new Rome. The other was America as promised land for a chosen people. As New Rome, America would compete with historically superior cultures in matters of literature, art, and overall cultural ascendancy. As chosen people, America was called to resist, even transcend, the corrupting influence of old world politics and religion. But very quickly, concerns developed regarding foreigners who might transport such corruption inside the new land. Religious groups that included Baptists, Quakers, Catholics, Jews, Mormons, Jehovah's Witnesses, Christian Science, and Muslims, as well as ethnic groups from Irish and Italians to Germans and Japanese to Vietnamese and Arabs. Many Protestants understood a Redeemer Nation as an important next step for the churches of the Reformation, forging at last a true Christian civilization and nationhood. This latter understanding of American identity was centered in a covenant between God and God's own righteous people. It required that they keep the biblical, moral, and national covenant or face divine retribution. Again, John Winthrop's treatise, A Model of Christian Charity, summed it up with this classic assertion. Here at the bottom, this is part of that document we just read from. Read that. If we shall deal.
If we shall deal falsely with our God and His word, we have undertaken so calls Him to withdraw His present help from us. We shall shame the faces of many of us, worthy deserters, and cause their prayers to be turned into curses upon us.
Yeah, blessing and danger work together. This spiritual mission appears throughout American Protestantism, echoed in the following examples. Jonathan Edwards asserted that 18th century religious awakenings and revivals would renew the church, ushering in a post-millennial golden age after Christ, with Christ's return after 1,000 years of peace. Edwards concluded, can you read that? And if these things, read that.
And if these things be so, it gives us more abundant reason to hope that what is now seen in America, and especially in New England, may improve the dawn of that glorious day.
Lyman Beecher, father of 13 little Beechers, including Harriet Beecher Stowe, echoed Edwards' vision, writing, can you read this?
There is no place on earth which continues in our law of Reformation place itself in circumstances
Beecher went out to Cincinnati, founded a theological seminary, and wrote the plea for the West in part because he said the Catholics are going to come down from Canada and they're going to come up from Mexico and they're going to cut a swath through the middle of the American continent and claim it for the Pope. You Protestants need to get out there and keep the Catholics at bay. This was a very important fear of Catholic immigrants mid-19th century. By the late 19th and early 20th century, Edwards' post-millennial views had been overshadowed by a premillennial idea that the world could only grow worse as a prelude to Christ's immediate return to establish his reign on earth immediately for 1,000 years. In the 20th century, Pentecostal Frederick Chide's belief that the U.S. was the nation with two wings of a great eagle, referenced in Revelation 12, led him to believe that the U.S. should be a major protector of Israel, in which he said, and you all can let me read this, perhaps it is more than a coincidence that USA is in the middle of USA land. That's bad history, don't you think? In a 1943 sermon, evangelical leader Harold Ockenguy declared, "The United States of America has been assigned a destiny comparable to that of ancient Israel, which was favored, preserved, and endowed, guided, and used of God." And Ockenguy feared that there are two roads, two destinies that the U.S. had. One, he says, is the road of the rescue of Western civilization by a re-emphasis on and revival of evangelical religion, and the other is a return to the dark ages of heathendom. And so the questions we ask, 21st century debates over the religious nature of the American Republic continue unabated. Is America a Christian nation? A Judeo-Christian nation? A nation grounded in three great Abrahamic faiths? Christianity, Judaism, Islam. Is American exceptionalism inherently religious, or does it simply mean that the U.S. is a uniquely free nation based on democratic ideals and personal liberty? Is it a formally Christian nation rapidly going secular, or a materialistic banana republic that uses religion as an expedient political sound and fury signifying nothing? All of those ideas can be found in the public square in this country. Those questions were there from the beginning, particularly for certain dissenters who challenged Redeemer Nation metaphors and resulting actions. Roger Williams, the quintessential dissenter, was one of the first. Williams was clear. There are no Christian nations, only Christian people, bound to Christ not by citizenship, but by faith. Historian Edmund Morgan wrote that for Williams, the sword of state could make a whole nation of hypocrites, but only God could make Christians. And God's grace simply did not operate on a national scale. Williams himself wrote, and you all can read that. This is from Roger Williams. We ought to all have Roger Williams' words in our mouths at least one time in our lives. Read that.
I ask, where was the truth of the authority and power of Christ Jesus? Whether in stately assembly of kings, nobles, and bishops, or in the two-edged sword of the Word and Spirit of God, in the mouth of that one single and yet most faithful witness of Christ Jesus.
Williams also challenged the idea that European invaders were the agents of God's new Israel in a pagan inhabited land. Writing in his Key to the Language of America, the first lexicon of Native American language ever printed. Let's read that. You all read that together.
When the Indians hear
the Lord. Stop just a minute. Everybody try to read that. This is worth saying out loud. Read that.
When Indians hear the Lord Hills, the Irish Englishman, the horrid oaths and murders wake. Thus say these Indians then, we wear no clothes, have many gods, and yet our sins are less. You are barbarians, pagans wild, in your lands the wilderness.
What year did Williams write that?
1643.
William's own critique of national chosenness was predicated on the idea that whenever a nation claims to be elected, some of its citizens always get left out, either because they are not Christian or because they are the wrong kind of Christians. He was right, of course. Even the briefest survey illustrates the pluralism of American faith traditions and the tendency of Americans to grant our much-touted religious liberty grudgingly to faith-based newcomers, sectarians, or otherwise outsiders. Let's just walk through this real quickly. Colonial Baptist exile from Massachusetts, jailed as nonconformists, for the 1640s. Colonial Quakers, exiled and executed. Mary Dyer, Quaker preacher, hanged on in Boston in 1660. Every woman in this class needs to know Mary Dyer's name and, if possible, her story. Shaker founder Mother Ann Lee, attacked by mobs, severely weakened, died in 1784. Joseph Smith, Mormon founder, shot by an anti-Mormon mob in Carthage, Illinois, June 27, 1844. Bloody Monday, August 6, 1855, Louisville, Kentucky, anti-Catholic mobs attacked German and Italian immigrants to keep them from voting. Catholic churches were ransacked, 22 killed. Minersville School District versus Gobitis, 1940, when the Supreme Court ruled that public schools could compel Jehovah's Witness-oriented children to say the Pledge of Allegiance or else suffer expulsion. One of my 90-year-old friends, who was a Jehovah's Witness young second grader in Massachusetts, got expelled in the 1950s for his failure, or 1940s, for his failure to say that, his refusal out of his own religious conviction to say the pledge. Ku Klux Klan bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church, Birmingham, September 15, 1963, resulted in the deaths of four elementary school-age girls in a Sunday school classroom. Sea Temple, Oak Creek, Wisconsin. Six people killed by a white supremacist, August 2012. June 17, 2015, Emmanuel African American Methodist Episcopal, African Methodist Episcopal Church, Charleston, South Carolina. Nine people shot to death by a 20-something white supremacist. Churches, synagogues, and mosques burned and vandalized across multiple generations throughout the United States. Some just last week. Thus, the racial, ethnic, and immigrant issues of a Redeemer nation bring us to the myth of the lost cause, when one region of the country sought to make its case in a literally divided nation. My father used to tell, I'm a native Texan, and my father, growing up in North Texas, used to tell me the story about the Texas politician running for office after the Civil War. After a rousing speech, an audience member asked, "Didn't you tell us that we could defeat the Yankees using corn stalks?" "Yes," the politician replied, "but the damn Yankees used guns." That's a bad joke. It's a bad joke. But it is a lost cause story. In her superb study of Ladies Memorial Associations in the post-war South, Carolyn Janey suggests that the lost cause became a way in which defeated Southerners shaped a collective memory that cast the war and its outcome in the best possible terms, often factually and chronologically distorting the way in which the past would be remembered. These alternative facts minimized or overlooked the role of slavery and enslaved culture as a reason for the war, instead asserting that Northern Reconstruction efforts were signs of Yankee aggression and black betrayal, and the denial of sectionalism, that is, states' rights. In words that sound strangely parallel to issues and ideologies of the 21st century, Janey writes, "The Lost Cause provided a sense of relief to white Southerners who feared being dishonored by defeat, and its rituals and rhetoric celebrated the memory of personal sacrifice in a region rapidly experiencing change and disorder." Thomas Connelly and Barbara Bellows write that the Lost Cause embodied the mental processes of an entire generation of Southerners in the late 19th century. So they attempted during the years of defeat to justify secession and military catastrophe. In a fascinating essay entitled "The Anatomy of the Myth," Alan Nolan insists that the Lost Cause was expressly a rationalization, a cover-up. His essay summarizes the elements that shape Lost Cause ideology beyond simply memorializing the dead or responding to veterans. He suggests that the Lost Cause created a sense of advocacy to perpetuate the Southern cause over against and beyond defeat. It also preserved the South's defensive posture over slavery and later Jim Crow segregation laws. Nolan also asserts that the Lost Cause advocates declared that the primary reason for the war was not in defense of chattel slavery, but of the autonomous states' rights, a sectionalism that included even the power of secession. In his study of the Lost Cause, Gaines Foster writes that few Southerners expressed any guilt over owning or the mistreatment of slaves, even though they had been raised in a society that encouraged the public confession of sin. Not only did Southerners refuse to repent of perpetuating slave culture, many affirmed their belief in its justness. Indeed, Lost Cause inventor Edward Pollard understood the Emancipation Proclamation as an economic travesty, writing that the South was a spectacle of ruin. And then he adds, "With the fruits of the toil of generations all swept into a chaos of destructions." He doesn't mean slaves. He means slave owners. Their slave property taken away by a stroke of the pen. A pecuniary loss of 2,000 millions of dollars involved in one single measure of spoliation, a penalty embraced in one edict. You see, Pollard wanted reparations for slave owners, not for slaves. In his infamous book, The Klansman, published in 1905, Baptist preacher, novelist, and Wake Forest College graduate, Thomas Dixon sums it up in a statement of a post-war Southern gentleman. The Klansman became the base for the silent movie, what? Birth of a Nation. Yes. Let's read from the Klansman. Come on.
Another cargo of humanity heaving to enjoy the blessings of
have been abolished gradually, Dixon contended, thus avoiding a war brought on by radical abolitionists. Alan Nolan responds that there is no evidence tending to show that the South would have ever voluntarily abandoned slavery. Instead, he said, the Southern states had openly abridged the U.S. Constitution in order to protect its own peculiar institution of slavery. Through it all, Protestant Christianity provided theological underpinning for lost cause mythology. Conley and Bellows write, the rising tide of evangelical faith witnessed in the phenomenal growth of the Southern Baptist Church and other fundamentalist churches gave solace and structure to the defeated Confederate generation. Likewise, school textbooks were carefully monitored by watchdog committees of veterans organizations, determined that the young would be offered the true story of the Civil War and its origins. In his monumental study, Baptized in Blood, The Religion of the Lost Cause, Charles Raven Wilson writes that as the guardians of the region's spiritual and moral heritage, Southern ministers used the lost cause to buttress this heritage. He contends that Christian clergymen were the prime celebrants of the religion of the lost cause and used it in ways that would enhance their own pastoral ministry for people who were hurting from having lost loved ones and for undergirding a way of thinking about the South. Wilson concludes that these ministers intended to warn Southerners of their decline from past virtue, to promote moral reform, to encourage conversion to Christianity, and to educate the young in Southern traditions. And in the fullness of time, they related it to the larger American values. In many ways, the lost cause was an effort to rewrite the South back into American national identity. In other ways, it portrayed the South as the prime preserver of the original myth of America as Redeemer Nation. As I have written elsewhere, the great lost cause myth, I think, is this. The people who lost the war retained the vision. The defeated people would, even in defeat, be more moral, more orthodox, more faithful to Christianity than their northern counterparts had been or ever would be. At the same time, this Christian vision facilitated, even glorified, the Ku Klux Klan and set the stage for Jim Crow. Such lost cause culture did not go unchallenged. Indeed, there may have been no greater rhetorical response to the failures of Redeemer Nation and lost cause mythology than in the Lincoln Memorial Address given by the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. at the 1963 Civil Rights March on Washington. King's words essentially call for making America great again for the first time. Given the inability of the nation to apply its democratic spiritual ideals to all persons. These days, we often rush to the soaring rhetoric of the I Had a Dream speech, but the opening of the speech contains the challenge to first-time greatness. And I'm going to put a lengthy section up here, and I want you to read it carefully out loud, because I think it's often overlooked. When we get to that, to the rhetoric of the conclusions. Start with this. This is King's words, Lincoln Memorial, 1963. Please read.
I have scored years ago, a great American, in the symbolic shadows that stand today, signed the Emancipation Proclamation. His momentous decree, England's great even quote, Later, the Negro still was hungry. 100 years later, prosperity. 100 years later, New York is still languished in the corners of American society, and finds himself in exile in his homeland. And so we come here today to prioritize the shameful condition. In a sense, we become our nation's capital to catch up.
Sure. Let me take this up. Again, he continued. When the architects of our republic wrote the magnificent words of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, they were signing a promissory note to which every American was to fall heir. This note was a promise that all men and women, yes, black men and women, as well as white men and women, would be guaranteed the unalienable right of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It is obvious today that America has defaulted on this promissory note insofar as her citizens of color are concerned. Instead of honoring this sacred obligation, America has given the Negro people a bad check, a check which has come back marked insufficient funds. Do you hear the way in which he challenges Redeemer Nation and Lost Cause mythology? King called out the Lost Cause language and practice when he declared on into it, "I have a dream that one day, down in Alabama with its vicious racists, with its governor having his lips dripping with the words of interposition and nullification," meaning sectionalism, "one day right here, right there in Alabama, little black boys and black girls will be able to join hands with little white boys and white girls as sisters and brothers." Sectionalism and states' rights, King said, were no excuse for segregation any more than they have been for slavery. King's dream for America captured elements of Redeemer Nation, free at last, free at last. But it rejected Lost Cause mythology and the racial, dare we say, racist views and actions that accompanied it then and now. Which brings us to some conclusions. Given these historical dynamics and the promises kept and neglected in American national and religious identity, where do we go from here? Three quick points. First, as myths like American exceptionalism or the Lost Cause give way or are reinterpreted, divisions are inevitable. No, they're not just inevitable, they're just happening in faith communities. The great myth analyst Joseph Campbell wrote, please read that.
"For it is a fact that the myths of our several cultures work upon us, whether consciously or unconsciously, as energy-releasing, life-motivating, and directing agents, so that even though our rational minds may be in agreement, the myths by which we are living, or by which our fathers lived, can be driving us at that very moment, diametrically apart."
These divisions are evident as American religious communities provide multiple responses to religio-national identity. A spectrum includes conservative evangelical Rob Dreher's insistence that historic Orthodox Christianity is so undermined in current American culture that Christians should consider his new book, The Benedict Option, taking themselves out of the culture wars and creating new monastic life environments for educating children, cultivating spirituality, and protecting genuine faith. New York Times editorial commentator David Brooks calls this the purest approach to faith and culture. That is, those who believe that everything in the world is part of a harmonious whole in which all questions point ultimately to a single answer. Other conservative Christians appear to be re-engaging in the culture war, viewing Donald Trump as a last-ditch vehicle for winning or at least gaining ground for their views of morality and faith. The Southern Baptist Convention, again, being a case in point. The current controversy over the ethics office executive Russell Moore's public critique of Trump has led many SBC leaders and churches to withhold funds from the denomination until Moore is replaced or disciplined, brought in line with the support of the new president, in keeping with the perceived majority of SBC-related Christians. African-American Southern Baptist leader Dwight McKissick responds, "The outcome of this investigation will speak volumes to black Southern Baptist convention churches as to whether or not any church leader or entity head who politically, who publicly, critically evaluate President Donald Trump will be welcome in the Southern Baptist Convention and eligible to serve in any or all levels of denominational life. Apparently, the SBC has added political inerrancy to its inerrant biblical and doctrinal non-negotiables, shades of lost cause mythology." In many contexts, mainline churches and African-American Christians have joined in pressing rhetoric and action of earlier civil rights protests in challenging changes in voter registration laws and other issues related to their sense of justice and compassion, particularly with the poor and the infirm. Some Christians, including certain Roman Catholic bishops and clergy, have formed coalitions to resist government actions regarding undocumented immigrants, actions begun under various policies of the Obama administration. And don't forget the nones. Varying groups that consider themselves spiritual but not religious, humanists or secularists, have increased public challenges of the Redeemer Nation mythology, offering alternative options for interpreting national identity. Ron Reagan, son of the former president, is one of the most public faces of that endeavor. Public radio commentator, Krista Tippett, wrote last month that we are among the first people, and she means your generation, we are among the first people in human history who do not broadly inherit religious identity as a given, a matter of kin and tribe. But the spiritual but not religious movement, she insists, is creating a transformation, perhaps even a reformation, with impulses, she writes, that would make more sense to Dietrich Bonhoeffer with his religionless Christianity than to Martin Luther. So, evaluating all that, Jeffrey Hobson writes, "The evolution of modern American social and political beliefs, including especially the core beliefs of liberty and democracy, has been more problematic than patriotic rhetoric complains. Freedom and democracy have not developed as smoothly or as easily as the preachers of American exceptionalism have told us." Second, the lost cause history reminds us that we must continue to examine and evaluate myths that inform our identity as citizens and people of faith. Hodgson's quote gets at that very point. The lost cause ideology illustrates that most poignantly. In response, I remind you, Martin Luther King called the nation to live out the greatness of its creed by applying it to all its citizens. Finally, what about our witness? With the decline of Protestant privilege in the U.S., might we join earlier generations of Christians in exploring more explicitly the nature and boundaries of witness in the face of mass culture, in the face of media religion, and in the struggle for Christian identity? Such a witness might compel us to take a chance, stake our consciences on ideas that inform and empower, even when we know they will never secure majoritarian approval or permission, a witness of the minority. Truett Theological Seminary professor Stephen Brett Reed raised a minority witness just yesterday when his was the 59th of 100 letters sent to the nation's president, vice president, cabinet officials, and all members of Congress as part of the Values and Voices Project. In this endeavor, both Dr. Reed and I joined 98 other academics from multiple institutions and faith traditions in addressing issues born of our own religious perspective. Reed begins by citing the prophet Micah's admonition to beat swords into plowshares and study war no more. He then turns to the Jesus story of the poor man Lazarus, ignored by the rich man at whose gate Lazarus sits. And then Reed turns prophetic, asking government officials, government leaders this. Read that, please.
How many more people like Lazarus will we see at our gates once budget cuts to those you need lead to an increase in homelessness? The demands of funding for programs like Meals on Wheels, how many more folk like Lazarus will be forced to beg for food or go hungry? When millions lose their health insurance, how many people will we see like Lazarus who is covered with sores and died from his illness?
In this era of American and Christian life, we have an historic opportunity, no obligation, to exercise the responsibility of the minority in our own culture, and for many of us, perhaps, in our own churches and denominations, speaking out from the depth of Christ-centered consciences as agents of justice, reconciliation, and compassion at home and abroad. Wouldn't it be amazing if in losing our cultural hegemony and privilege, we recovered our voice, not as entitlement, but as gospel? If not now, when? World without end. Amen. Now, you talk back to me.
Thank Dr. Lennon for his lecture, and then I hope that you all stay. A couple of you are going to leave, but we're going to reconvene in about 45 seconds.
Would it be okay if we just started while people are, it's going to take
this moment. Yeah, let's go ahead and have some questions. We'd just like for you to raise your hand. Dr. Lennon is, as you know, a professor. I'm going to let him handle this himself. You don't have to talk to me. I'm just going to talk to him. I wouldn't hear you anyway.
Questions?
First question. Anybody? Do we start over here, maybe? Somebody in my class has the first question, right? Somebody. Right?
Yes, sir.
In the back.
My question. To what extent is racial violence integral or incidental to this mythology of the lost cause? I'm thinking specifically in terms of lynching in the late 19th and early 20th century, where mobs will hang, burn, castrate, and shoot black men, women, and children of people as kind of an extension of this kind of ideology. To what extent is racial violence?
Joe, hear that? To what extent is racial violence endemic into the nature of Redeemer Nation? Is it inseparable? Well, it was there from the beginning. That's even before you get to KKK lynching. The physical abuse of Africans, who came to America, was consistent. And I'm going to get to more specifics about lynching, but I think this is an important point. One of the reasons that a great many Southern preachers gave for their defeat in the Civil War was their insistence that slave owners had been violent and had not followed the biblical, quote-unquote, teaching of St. Paul on how, and Hebrew Bible, on how to treat slaves. And that was an extremely important point. And you have a number of Baptist periodicals in the immediate post-Civil War explaining that violence had been, had slave owners cared as Christians for their slaves, it would have happened. But, since we're talking, the Nat Turner, do you all know the Nat Turner Rebellion, the 1830s? The Nat Turner Rebellion gave the lie to that because Turner was supposedly the benevolent recipient of Christian practices by his owners. So that whole issue of physical violence was endemic. It was inseparable from slavery. One of the things that is clear when you read the book by Thomas Dixon, The Klansman, and in some ways his even worse book called The Leopard's Spots, is you see that one of the ways in which post-Civil War anti-Reconstruction Southerners reasserted their control over African-American communities was in the name of a particular kind of protection for the community, doing their duty against particularly African-American males. And that once that got underway, particularly by what is sometimes called the second phase of the KKK, that became increasingly a method of a fear tactic with amazing poignance and violence. So I think that was there. But I'd remind you, I'm thinking, and some of you have to help me here, it hasn't been too long ago, post-lynching era, when, was it Marshall, Texas? Was it in Marshall, Texas? Where a young African-American was killed, mutilated, and dragged behind a pickup truck. That's late 20th century, wasn't it? Or was it the early 2000s? And so those actions that not only result in death, but often mutilation or particularly violent deaths remain on the horizon all the time. But yes, it was there. And became in that second phase of the Lost Cause, became a one of those rituals. That's ritualistic killing. Were you wanting to go anywhere else with that? That's a very important point.
Yeah, that's fine. I know other people will have questions.
Okay. Yes?
I'll connect to that. And what way is this Lost Cause narrative, more specific or more broadly American exceptionalism, also confined or narrowed to a sense of Anglo-Saxon Protestant exceptionalism?
In what ways is the Lost Cause and the Redeemer Nation founded on Anglo-Saxon Protestantism? That's a very important question, and you give me a chance to say something I didn't put in the manuscript, and I really wanted to be careful about covering time. Martin Luther King and Malcolm X disagree significantly about the nature of the American myth. In a book called Malcolm and Martin, which I recommend to you, in which King said, the myth is still intact, as we read. It simply needs to be applied, to live out the greatness of the creed in applying it. Malcolm X said, the creed, the myth, was wrong from the beginning, because it was always about white people, not only about white people as predominant, but about white people handling people of color in their place. And that's been one of the major points of discussion and struggle and dialogue. And why, I left this out for the sake of time. Each of my points in that first point has a quote from contemporary, and since you raised that, I'll just, do you all know who Steve King is? Yeah. Steve King is an Iowa legislator. And a week ago, Steve King said, tweeted, of course, I'm quoting, that culture and demographics are our destiny. We can't restore our civilization with somebody else's babies. And then he doubled down by saying, if you go down the road a few generations or maybe centuries with intermarriage, I'd like to see an America that's just so homogeneous that we look a lot the same from that perspective. And then, of course, he concludes, I think there's been far too much focus on race, especially in the last 8 years. Well, that's an outspoken resurrection of lost cause language and Anglo-Saxon-based myth. And it's just right here. And I finished that by saying, when Iowans sound like 19th century, when 21st century Iowans sound like 19th century Southerners, we've still got a long way to go. So there's a sense in which part of what I think we are struggling with right now in this whole issue of identity, which is where we start, is the question of whether we are at a particular moment in American history when many of those ideas, long either dormant or kept under wraps, have been released with a vengeance. And that's part of what I think we have to talk about and respond, because look how quickly the analogies and the language come from a person in Congress. Yes.
Actually, that comment helps me to frame my question, which has to do with the impact of the lost cause myth on people outside the South. It has sometimes seemed to me that notion of the lost cause allows people in the rest of the country, obviously not Stephen King, to assume that racism is a Southern problem. And if only those people would fix it, then there wouldn't be a problem. Okay. Do you think those things are connected in some way?
Yes. Did you all hear racism is a Southern thing?
I didn't say that. I was
No. I mean, that view is there. I think the South has been scapegoated. And one of the reasons I wanted to use King is this is the Midwest, the pristine Midwest, you know. So I would say two things. One is, I think it's been a way of, that may be underneath this comment, we've talked too much about race, and African Americans want us to make race the central feature here, and we've got to move on. And some of that idea that we're now a post-racial society, that's part of it. But the other thing is scapegoating, I saw a thing about King that he keeps a Confederate battle flag on his desk. So I would say the other side of that is maybe the way in which lost cause metaphors have leaked out of the South into the larger culture as well, particularly evident on the social media. Yes?
That kind of brings up my question about the relationship between the Southern lost cause motif and then this American exceptionalism, which you're pointing out has been present from the beginning of the country. So can you just kind of talk about the relationship between those? Is the lost cause, has it been termed just a Southernization after the Civil War of the exceptionalism that was always there?
I would say that from my perspective, the lost cause metaphor and methodology was a way of helping the South come to terms with the reality that they lost the war and they were back in the Union. And in doing that, part of the task of those who shaped it was to rewrite the South back into the Redeemer Nation. And that's my point from I wrote this book called God's Last Known Hope, Fragmentation of the Southern Baptist Convention in 1990. And Charles Reagan Wilson was my great mentor in coming to terms with this. See, listen again to this way of saying it. The people who lost the war retained the original vision of a Redeemer Nation. The defeated people would, even in defeat, be more godly, more moral, more orthodox, and I didn't have this, in that sense, more American than their northern counterparts had been or would be. So there's a sense in which the lost cause is a subcategory, but it's not even a dotted line, I think, because it's a way in which now that we don't have a nation anymore and we've got to go back to those folks, let's realize that we kept the vision alive even though we lost. And that in a sense was the brilliance of it in terms of riding people back in. But in order to get them back in, post-Reconstruction, and this gets to Professor Galinta's comment, I think, the rest of the country helped write the lost cause back in order to make it possible to have the South. So, Jim Crow was legislated and permitted by the whole country, not just in the South. Thank you all.
Thank you all.